Would the House Finance please come to order? The first bill we'll take up is House Bill Number 530, an act relating to the establishment and operation of a state boarding school by the Department of Education and providing for an effective date. This is by the rules. We have it before. It has a zero fiscal note at this time. Is there anybody that would like to testify on this bill? Mr. Loresch? Would you state your name for the record, please?
For the record, my name is Larry Roshlow. I'm superintendent of schools at Mount Inchon High School. And basically, Mr. Chairman and committee members, House Bill 530 was a bill written that the primary purpose of the bill is to put Mount Inchon High School under the regular state foundation program for funding purposes. The bill would, with 170 students, we would generate about 17.33 units of regular ed plus one unit each in bilingual, special ed, and vocational education for a total of 20.33 units, which would put us fairly close to the governor's budgeted amount. In fact, we would be under the governor's budgeted amount that he currently has under the Department of Education line item. The residential portion of Mount Edgecombe High School then would remain under the Department of Education as a line item, which in my opinion is not a good situation. I think that would be much more preferable if both the residential and the instructional were under the foundation program, but there was not much support for moving the residential portion under the foundation program, basically because I think that that would have probably opened up the foundation program again, and there was not a lot of support to do that. The fiscal note on this bill is approximately zero. Mary Hackla is here, and I think that there would be, if there would be any special questions concerning the finer points of the bill concerning the fiscal note, Mary could answer those. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd entertain whatever questions might have from the committee or yourself.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Gibson Larson.
Yes, I guess just a brief question, although it might take a long answer. What would be different under this piece of legislation than what exists now?
I think basically, Representative Larson, that our funding, rather than going through the normal state executive system of going through Department of Ed and then through the governor's office, then eventually to the legislature, our funding for the instructional portion of our budget would be then set by the number of students and by the types of programs that we have, similar to every other district in the state.
Would you then charge tuition to your students? Is that something that would be different, or is that something that you could possibly do under this, or?
That was not addressed, Representative Larson. As far as charging our students tuition, we're a fairly poor student body in that 70% of our students qualify for either free or reduced price meals. I know that this year we accepted, I believe it was about 195 students, but when we actually opened, only 175 showed up, and the reason for that was that we required the students to pay one way of transportation. So when the final crunch came to actually paying for the plane ticket, we feel that probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20 students were unable to come to Mount Edgecombe just because they were not able to pay for the ticket. So I think you may, I guess my fear would be, from a personal standpoint, of making it an elitist school.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, you know, that was my concern, too. I was wondering if this was leading up to the, you know, the charging of tuition. It's not that I favored the charging of tuition. I was fearful that this might do just what you said. Can you tell me a little bit more about how the funding mechanism would take place, and where would your dollars be found in the budget to operate both the academic and the housing portion?
Currently, we are funded for both a residential portion of our budget and an instructional portion of our budget within the Department of Education's budget. It's my understanding that what would take place is the instructional portion of the monies that are included now under DOE's budget would then be moved and placed into the foundation program in order to increase the foundation program, which then we would receive the funds back through the foundation program. And then the residential portion would remain similar to how it is.
And I guess my last question is how is that going to make things better than what presently is?
One of the main problems we've had is that House Bill 530 takes care of the teacher tenure problem in that it places our teachers under the same system as other school districts are, and the State Board of Education then or its representative can bargain with the teachers then in a normal situation. Right now, our teachers, the only option they have is really to unionize, to become an official union of the state, and then to bargain, which takes, it's my understanding, somewhere in the neighborhood of almost a year to accomplish all of that. And our teachers really don't want to do that. They just want to be treated like every other teacher in the state is treated, and they feel it's only fair. And I guess I agree with that. Whether you agree or disagree with tenure, I think that our one thing that we do need to do is to treat our teachers like every other teacher is treated, and I think that's only fair.
And I think we did put the money in the budget last year to do that. I guess one last question. You know, I've heard a lot of good things about your Pacific Rim language program. Do you have two full-time people on your staff to direct or to oversee how the teachers will put that into their curriculum so that they can teach the students?
We have...
You don't have to answer that. I'm just being facetious here.
I heard the conversations yesterday, Representative Larson, and...
But you figure your teachers are qualified to go ahead and do that without the oversight or direction or the curriculum development from some outside source?
Personally, I help those teachers a lot myself.
Thank you.
And so does my principal. And they also receive a lot of support from other teachers, and they support each other. I feel that Mount Edgecombe High School would be the place if you wish to put some administrative monies into Pacific Rim. Mount Edgecombe High School would be more than willing to accept that responsibility, and we would do whatever needs to be done in order to run that program, and that would really be the best place to put it. We've got 3 years of experience under our belts.
I appreciate that. In fact, I heard a comment to that effect yesterday. Thank you.
Ms. Hockley, do you would like to comment?
No, I just wanted to be sure that
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have two things in the bill that I don't understand. Could you, on page 6, line 5, can you explain what that says, that section 3?
The 874,
is right.
Representative Rieger?
Yeah, so lines 5 through 10.
A normal school district is allowed to keep 10% of their Public Law 874 monies. And so this would then treat Mount Edgecombe High School as other schools are treated.
Okay. Thank you. And that's all I need. And one other question. Just as a general question, as enrollment, have you run the numbers, as enrollment shifts to Mount Edgecombe from some other school districts, as a general rule, is the total entitlement under the foundation formula increased or decreased kind of a student-by-student basis?
We are currently 84% rural. Our student dollars per student cost is approximately $14,000 per student of just state dollars. how that would compare with REAA districts, I would think that it would be about a wash, but I'm not sure. We would have to take each individual student, for instance, if they were from an expensive REAA, such as the Aleutians, or from a cheap REAA like Delta Greeley, and then we would have to, I would guess, individually look at each one of those to see what would happen. But I would guess on an overall basis, probably it would be fairly close to it would not increase or decrease.
And your 14,000 includes the room and board and all?
Yes, it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Representative Pichot.
Yeah, I had a couple questions. One on the fiscal note. If Mary Hockler, are you going to
Can you move up, please?
Sure. Maybe while she's moving up, though, I did have another question on this 14-16-060 on treating employees of Mount Edgecombe as state employees. Is that, why is that?
What's the situation? Is that on, Representative Pichot?
Page 4, line 25.
Is that an affirmation of the status quo, or is that a change?
That would be those employees that are not the teachers would remain in the classified service. The secretaries, the accountant, the maintenance staff, those who are not teachers would remain state employees and under state personnel rules.
That's where they are now.
Yes.
That is also what is the case at Avtec, the state-operated school at Seward. It's also the case for centralized correspondence study.
One of the reasons, Representative Pichot, that we were able to, we are able to provide that kind of education at the $14,000 per student figure is that we contract out our food service, our janitorial, our security. And so a lot of where there would normally be state employees, we put that out for contracted service. So that does save us a considerable amount of money. We only have 32 state employees at the school, including the teachers.
Mr. Chairman, maybe if I can make this real short. Is this correct, then? You're moving from the regular GF line item for instructional. You're essentially moving that money would be coming out of the foundation formula. And then the little glitch there, the only difference is then that you're putting a round-trip plane ticket into residential GF, and that is being backed out of that instructional GF category.
Essentially, yes. Under the bill, it says that one of the obligations is in terms of the boarding and that the state would be requesting funds for round-trip transportation for the students as part of the residential program cost. So that
as far as residential as opposed to instructional. So that's why the number of in the K through 12 support foundation is actually a little smaller than the instructional, the former GF instruction category. Thank you.
Just to maybe further elaborate, Mr. Chairman, if I could on that point. Our students right now are just provided with one way of transportation, and what we're asking for in the regular operating budget then is to have a one round trip of transportation rather than just the one way. And the Alaska Association of School Boards, I see, came out with a resolution that they feel that 100% of students' transportation for all Alaska students should be paid for. So I'm glad to have the School Boards Association agree with that also.
Whether they're going by bus or by airplane.
Yeah.
Any further questions?
Just one brief one. Just on that question, probably the transportation money should more correctly be put under pupil transportation.
We did look at that, Representative Larson. Unfortunately, at the present time, given the current regulations and statutes governing the pupil transportation program, Edgecombe and a round-trip transportation to and from the boarding school, the airfare does not qualify. So we would propose that we keep it separate and very clearly an outline of the cost that we estimate so that would be recognized and treated. Right.
Would that take a change in regulation or a change in statutes?
I believe statute. I'd have to go back and double check.
That's probably what more properly should be put to guarantee it year after year.
Representative Boyer.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for coming in a few minutes late on this, and also apologize for not being better prepared, but
The board is the state's school board, then?
Yes.
In all cases? So they act like any other local school board in any other district acts with regard to the school, with regard to your budget and those types of things?
In all honesty, Representative Boyer, I don't think you could say it would act the same, because we don't have two meetings a month with the state board where just Mount Edgecombe is looked at. But and that's why I say I don't know if this is the most ideal way to handle the situation, but we've really come up with no formula for residential costs at this point in order to put the whole thing under the foundation program. But then you would have a whole separate board, probably, which could be very expensive. And so probably a better way to do, a cheaper way to do business, to leave it under the State Board of Education. And then the problem is that it does become unwieldy sometimes administratively. The chain of command is myself, then it goes to the deputy commissioner, then to the commissioner, then to the board. And so sometimes we do have some problems that way. But so far it hasn't been unmanageable. It's been workable.
And the department doesn't feel that that's too unwieldy, that to administer this small school like another district school board would administer their school district budgets?
It felt to be workable. There were many different alternatives initially looked at. In terms of governance structure, this was the best solution and most efficient solution that was found.
I think in the future, Representative Boyer, though, that the state board 2 to 3 years down the line is looking at turning the school over and having a separate board at Mount Edge. We are, another thing that enters kind of into the picture is many times we're looked at as a model school and used by the Department of Education to promote different types of programs and to write curriculum and to help other schools, and we fill that role right now. And so that does help other districts in the state also.
And your non-certified employees will be covered under para as opposed to under current law, they don't have any bargaining rights at all, or under a proposed legislation now in the Senate would be covered under the same statutes as teachers.
Our teachers would be covered under teachers' retirement system, which they are a part of the teachers' retirement system. Most of our teachers are members of NEA. However, they are not a bargaining unit. And I believe, is centralized correspondence study a bargaining unit? I think they are a separate unit. So in order for our teachers to organize, they would have to do something similar.
Form a unit?
Centralized, yes.
But your non-certified employees, and I only ask that because on page 4.
Classified.
Yeah.
Those people are in regular unions such as Local 71.
So they are now?
Yes, they are
okay,
now.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Thank you, too. Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill?
It's a pleasure of the committee.
Question for show.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we report on House Bill 530 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill we'll take up is House Bill 137, campaign. This was in subcommittee, was chaired by Representative Brown. She will explain the changes that was made on this particular bill. Representative Brown, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a subcommittee of 4 members, and we met and discuss this bill and are proposing 4 changes in the committee substitute. The first one in Section 3 basically collapses into a single limit what was formerly 2 limits, one for parties and a separate limit for corporations, unions, and PACs. Those are now included so that there is a single limit. And that basically came from the concern expressed by Representative Gall at the last meeting we had on this about the independent candidate and not desiring to set up a structure that inherently discriminates against an independent candidate. So we think this is a good solution to that. The second change is on is also to Section 3, and this would extend the election campaign until the end of the year for statewide and legislative candidates until 60 days following the election for local candidates, and the definition of election campaign is when a candidate can receive money. And the concern here that was expressed by Representative Boyer was that we be sure to think about the challenger and how the challenger will fare under this system that's being proposed. And it was pointed out that challengers often have more difficulty attracting the PAC money or the organized interest money during a run for office. And secondly, that many candidates find it necessary to advance money to make expenditures and later hope the money will come in, and that a challenger would be at a disadvantage if there was not a few weeks after the election to recover that. I think this is an improvement over the status quo, where we have, you know, constant fundraising, that it does allow appropriate flexibility. And I think we have some difference of opinion on the subcommittee on that, and I believe in a moment Representative Frank will make a minority report on that section. The other two changes are more minor. The change in Section 4 clarifies that recovery of a personal loan would take place during the time of the campaign, and there again we're thinking about the challenger or the startup candidate who would find it necessary to advance money to the campaign and would be able to recover it during the campaign. And finally, Section 4, we deleted some language from the earlier version that limited the use of office account funds to certain specific activities, and it was pointed out that there is another statute that governs what is appropriate to do with an office account, and we didn't feel that it was appropriate to have a mixed set of rules on the office account, and that should be better left to the other statute. So I'd ask the other members of the subcommittee if they have anything to add. It was Representative Boyer, Gall, and Frank.
Representative Frank.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if I'd call it a minority report. I think I'd rather refer to it as a substantial agreement with a couple of exceptions. The first is an amendment. I guess I should have put my name on it. I'm sorry. With regard to the date of idea of post-election fundraising. And the thing that concerns me about post-election fundraising is just the appearance of being able to buy influence after the date of the election. And I'm not convinced that it's that it's a good idea to allow post-election fundraising. And moreover, I'm not convinced or I don't necessarily buy the argument that post-election fundraising allows a challenger to borrow money and then pay it back and recoup his investment and that sort of thing. You'd have to be somebody of means to borrow money anyway. So I don't think you're going to discriminate between the well-to-do and the not-so-well-to-do, or truly a person without means isn't going to be able to go out and borrow anyway. To me, it's just bad policy to let a successful candidate go out and raise funds to pay off their loans to their campaign that they've made. This amendment would limit it to the day before the date of the election. By the day before the election, if you haven't raised your funds by then, in my opinion, it's you should know what's going on, and it basically just prevents post-election fundraising. I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions.
Representative Boyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I argued against the original language in the bill, which this amendment would revert to, and I argued against the original language, and I would argue against the amendment because primarily the language, well, in one sense, what the language would do is certainly favor incumbents, and why it favors incumbents is, as all of us know, as having been challengers, some of us to incumbents, others not. But certainly those of us who have challenged incumbents is that it's difficult to raise money in an election when you're running against an incumbent, particularly if you're an unknown candidate, because people aren't willing to risk offending an incumbent, particularly an incumbent who might be a chairman of a standing committee that those people may have to do business with in the future. But believe me, the day that you win the election, everybody comes forward with a check that they would have come forward with had they not had concerns about how an incumbent might deal with their legislation or their future. And I think it's an unfair limiting feature of the proposal and as the bill was originally drafted, and that's why I argued against it. And more importantly, though, there are, I think, a lot of people who set out a budget and you decide what your agenda is and what you're going to have to do to win an election, and you create a budget, and you spend money as if that money is going to be there, and you're continually trying to raise money as part of the campaign, and you may well not have collected all of the money that you would have spent, and people can dig deep into their own pocket on by election day to have afforded themselves that budget to win the campaign, and I don't think that we should disallow a person then from going out and trying to recoup some of those personal dollars. And I argued in subcommittee that any date is artificial. If you're going to argue for a date before the election date, you might as well argue for the date of filing for the office, because any date is clearly arbitrary. I mean, if you've either got the money under the people who propose this language, you've either got the money or you don't. And I happen to disagree with that because, again, I think there are that you don't allow the broadest range of participation by the public by this kind of language. Clearly, there are people who would go out and I said when the bill was before the full committee before, who would make almost any effort near the end of a campaign to be able to spend at least what their challenger was spending to be competitive, to continue to be competitive, and I think that those people ought to have an opportunity to recoup expenditures.
Representative Gull?
I just wanted to ask the maker of the amendment, through the chair, Steve, what's your position on borrowing of money in campaigns, period? It seems to me that, just to explain the question briefly, it seems to me that if you incur a debt, you're liable for that debt. And apart from the issue of of personal loans to the campaign, just third-party loans, if you didn't need time after the campaign to repay that debt, you wouldn't need to borrow the money. You could just accrue the expenditure, I guess is the way it's phrased on the reporting form, and then having collected that money prior to the end of the campaign, pay it back. I guess what I feel it, and I'm not sure that limiting it to the beginning of the session does the job either, or the end of that year does the job either. I don't have an answer to this, but I'm trying to find out philosophically where you're headed, because it seems to me that what you're really saying is that there should be no accrued expenses at the end of the campaign unless you as an individual are able to write a check for those out of your pocket and just eat that loss. Now, as I indicated earlier, I haven't borrowed money in campaigns, and my campaigns are maybe $20,000 to $21,000 tops, so I'm not in the same position as those guys running for office where they've got to develop $100,000 or something, which includes federal office and the whole gamut of these situations. But you get somebody who has to raise a lot of money, and they're just not going to be able necessarily to do it. I think I've described the different thoughts I've had, but my question to you is, if you're going to bring the limit back to the end of the election, what are you going to do about accrued expenses? Because it just seems to me that you're saying to anybody who would take your credit that you're not going to be able to pay your bills unless you are personally going to put your house on the line to run for office.
Well, I appreciate the thrust of your question, and I guess I'm trying to deal with it in a philosophical manner to try to bring some true reform to campaign financing, because I think it's necessary, and I think the original bill, you know, was much more comprehensive and did a better job. The problem that I see is people being able to contribute substantial sums of money to people, not on the basis of their philosophy or whatever, but based upon the fact that they won the election. Now, if they're so darn supportive, why don't they do it beforehand? If they believe in the philosophy that that person, that that candidate espouses, then let them put up before the election. But to be able to go out and recoup after makes you wonder, where were they before the election? I mean, where's their commitment to ideals or to positions or whatever? It seems to me that what we're further encouraging here is a system where the incumbents, through their influence, whether they were incumbents, just, you know, new incumbents or old incumbents, are going to be accepting campaign contributions of up to $1,000 after the results of the election are known. It's like it takes all the risk out of it, takes all the commitment out of it. It's hardly a financial commitment or risk or stake for a influential PAC or corporation or union or whatever special interest to give $1,000 after they know who's going to win and to make a decision. Maybe they supported the other side, and then now they'll give the victor $1,000 after the election. To me, it just smacks of inappropriate campaign financing, and I don't think unless we eliminate some of these things, I don't think we've really made an honest effort at campaign financing reform. I passed out another amendment that, in conjunction would really, I think, get at the heart of the, or at least make a more comprehensive attempt to get at the heart of true campaign financing reform, and that is to bring the amount down from $1,000 to $500 to spread out the contributions to a much broader group of people, and hopefully make the $100 contribution more important, and frankly make the person go out and solicit many small contributions instead of one or a smaller number of large contributions. I know that it's hard to go ask 10 people for $100. It's a lot easier to accept a $1,000 contribution from a special interest group. And my concern is that if we are going to take this campaign financing on, that let's try to do it in a way that will affect some real change and bring the thing back to the point where the general population is again involved in campaign financing. And that's it.
Thank you, Mr.
The chair doesn't recognize any amendments at this time. The chair would like to, at this time, look to us to adopt the committee substitute so we have a bill to be brought before us, and then we can look at the amendments then. Representative Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the proposed committee substitute.
Any objections? There are no objections. We have the committee substitutes before us. Is there anybody that would like to testify on the main bill before we go to the amendments? Representative Gull?
Thank you, sir. Yes, please.
Read it.
Sir, through the chair, if I read the bill correctly, this applies to the losers as well as the winners as far as this cutoff date on collection of debt. Is that correct?
I don't believe it does. I think we covered that the other day, that it was only conflict of interest.
That part is a different section, and that's why I raise it. The conflict of interest section deals with collection during the legislative session. But this section says that if you lose the election, if I understand it correctly, and Representative Brown, I hope, will correct me if I'm wrong, if you lose the election and you're in debt, you're out of luck also. And it seems to me that what that's going to say is that you're really taking a heck of a personal risk to run for office if you have any accrued expenditures on election day, which I think would stifle the competition that you're trying to support.
I don't believe that that's correct, Representative Gall. I'm looking at page 1, line 24. A candidate may accept a contribution only during an election campaign. I think it is our intent to say that contributions for the political contributions can be given and accepted during this period of time that begins September 1, the year before the election, and ends December 31, the year of the election.
So then that is correct, that both the winner and the loser cannot recover their debt after the end of the calendar year in which the election took place.
Yes.
Right. I guess I won't speak further on the amendment except to say that I think both of the sides of this question are really not fully responding to the problem, which is, can you accrue expenditures in an election that need to be repaid at some point in time? You don't have the personal finances to do so, and it seems to me whether you cut it off, I mean, I think it's great to say the winner should not be able to get rewarded for his power financially. But
that's the intent.
I agree with that intent, but I think what's happening here is that Representative Boyer's language does, to some extent, allow that door to remain open. But if you close the door the way the bill is closing it and the way the amendment closes it, there is no opportunity for a loser to recover any money he's accrued in expenditures. And my personal feeling is that may be more of a limitation on the democratic process than allowing it to just remain completely open the way it is today. And for that reason, if I were going to amend the bill, which I'm not, to achieve your point, I would take that limit out entirely, because that way a loser knows, as, and we can cite particular elections like the congressional election of last 2 years ago, where that individual had to spend a considerable amount of time to recoup her debt. I don't know if she's done so today. And that opportunity would be foreclosed, and that would mean, at least to me, and I would suspect to you, that it would be quite a risky business to run for Congress. I don't think that's the intent of the amendment, and yet it's a problem that seems to remain. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just know that this doesn't apply to federal...
Well, I mean, or to run for governor, you know, whatever.
Jefferson Frank?
Well, I was just going to say, no, it wasn't really intent, and I wouldn't have any problem with the loser being able to continue to raise funds to pay off campaign debts, and I guess I'd have to take some time to draft an amendment to achieve that purpose. But I think it's the incumbent, or excuse me, not the incumbent, it's the current office holder that is my concern. I mean, the winner, I should say.
Chairman?
I guess Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have another kind of version on this, and I don't know. I don't really know how to address it, but let's say that you have a contested primary. The person that wins the primary continues to raise funds. The person that loses the primary is out of luck. So if you cannot collect, if you have a primary and you've lost the election, I don't know if that person could then continue to collect money after that primary or not. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And I think an amendment, or I should probably draw an amendment that would limit it to losers. Or excuse me, limit the post-election. Yeah, post-election fundraising to losers.
I was just going to comment in response to Representative Davis. In the primary, the election campaign is defined so that it goes up through the general. So somebody who lost in the primary, even under the Frank Amendment, could keep raising money up until the day before the general. And on this issue of treating losers and winners differently, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because I think at the point in early October when the choice is before you, am I going to purchase that television, am I going to reserve that time, you don't know whether you're going to be the winner or the loser. And I think that part of what we're trying to do here is set up a structure that encourages candidates to live within their means and run a logical budget. And I just don't see the logic in saying, well, you know, it's going to apply differently to somebody who loses. And I think personally that we should stick with the committee substitute and vote down the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to echo that again for the record now that we have the amendment before us, that I mean, what happens in the existing system is that you do buy influence, and you buy influence by funding incumbents. And, you know, I can't speak for the credibility of people who contribute to campaigns, but by and large, if you look over the APOC statements of people who've been around these halls, the money goes to incumbents. It doesn't go to newcomers, regardless of their philosophical bent or anything else. And so people do buy influence before the election as well as after the election in some sense. I mean, if that's what your argument is. And I think you need to provide a mechanism whereby if people feel like they've got to contribute to somebody after the election to keep the door open. I mean, that's what people do. I mean, if we're being honest here, and I'd like to be honest for the record, that's exactly what people do, that the door stays open, because you otherwise penalize the newcomer. The person who's a challenger is absolutely at a disadvantage to the incumbent. And, of course, I should be glad now that I'm an incumbent. I hopefully won't have to worry about that. But, unfortunately, in running my first race, I mean, it was tough. And there were a lot of people who came up as early as July and said, you're a great candidate, but you're either running against the wrong guy because of the position he's in or whatever, but they declined to donate. And not that those people ever stepped forward and gave me $100 checks or $500 checks or $1,000 checks, but that was a fact of life that I was operating under, and I got no check. So I think it is important that you keep things somewhat balanced and give the opportunity an equal opportunity to a challenger by providing an opportunity for that person to put his or her own assets on the line, go ahead, stick to a budget, and be able to recoup some of those dollars after a campaign is over.
The only comment I have is on page number 2 and D2, and I'm sorry, Representative Wallace isn't here. It just gives a maximum to any House members of $20,000. She has 52 villages to travel to and has a primary and a general she cannot cover in travel. As can we make an exemption that whereas you live in the urban areas, you can go around with a pair of tennis shoes, and she needs to fly to each of her villages?
Yes. we had a lot of discussion on that point in the State Affairs Committee, and the State Affairs Committee must have had 8 or 10 meetings on this bill over the course of a year. And it was a concern of Representative Hoffman in how rural districts would be affected. But, Mr. Chairman, I'd just point out that the limit, the $20,000 limit we're talking about here, is just from large sources. A candidate has the ability under this bill to raise an unlimited amount of dollars from individuals. So it's not an absolute limit on the amount of money that can be raised. And, you know, we did go back and forth on the differences between large rural areas and compact urban areas. And, of course, you know, one factor that affects large urban areas is the cost of the media and the fact that to be a competitive candidate, you need to participate in the media, which is also very expensive. So I think after a lot of debate, that committee concluded that there just wasn't a fair way to do it other than to just say if we're going to try to lower the cost of campaigning and put a limit on it, and what we're trying to do is reduce the relative influence of special interests relative to the influence of individual people, that this was a reasonable approach to try.
Representative Frank, the chair is ready to take up amendment number 1 at this time.
I move the amendment.
Objection.
Is there any debate on amendment number 1? Any further debate?
I don't have any further debate. I think I've debated it.
Further debate? Roll call vote.
Representative Gall?
Mm-hmm.
On the amendment?
No. Baker?
No.
Motion fails. Amendment number two. Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Should I move the amendment now, or okay, I move the amendment, ask unanimous consent.
Jack? There's objection. We're on amendment number two.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that many of the arguments against or in favor of post-election fundraising would be appropriate in arguing for this particular amendment, i.e. involving more little people, if you will, into the process.